Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Easter as Easter season continues. And since it's Easter, man, let's talk a little bit about Easter. There's nothing in the world more joyful than Easter. We don't always feel it, of course. It's not just like an emotional thing we carry around all the time, like, oh, I'm so happy about Easter. I don't mean it that, but I mean real joy comes from as we grow and mature in the faith and we develop a confidence that it is true that the Lord is risen. And what that means for all of our worries, for all of our upsets, for all of our trials in this life, the fact that just those few days after suffering, the greatest suffering ever, there he is, risen from the grave, alive forever. The morning star. It's fun to talk about, actually. 888-318-7884 is our number if you would like to talk about Christ's resurrection. Today, we're particularly going to talk about the impact of the resurrection on those first people who first experienced Christ risen. And if you would like to talk about that, the early church and what the resurrection meant to the early church, they seem to have kind of a weird reaction to it at some points. We'll talk about that. 888-318-7884. Our guest to talk about this is none other than Joe Heschmeyer. Joe's been involved with the world of Catholic apologetics and catechesis since 2009 when he began the wonderfully named blog Shameless Popery, which I highly recommend you check out. After graduating from Georgetown Law Center, he briefly worked as a litigator in Washington, D.C. Please don't hold that against him. But he left the law to go to the seminary, spent 5 years in seminary, did not discern a call to the priesthood, but now he works for the School of Faith, which provides formation for Catholics with a particular emphasis on mentoring those who have the responsibility to teach the faith to others. Joe Heschmeyer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So what would you say if I said the Lord is risen?
Hallelujah. The Lord is risen indeed.
And why would you say that, Joe? Like, it's like 2,000 years ago. Why would you say that?
Because it's not just a past reality. It's a life-changing present reality.
Yeah, and I that word reality, like, it's very, very important, as we have tried to stress many, many times here on Catholic Answers, that the resurrection of Jesus bodily from the tomb is a historical event. It's real. It happened within human history. We're not talking about a myth. We're not talking about a hallucination or whatnot. It's a real event that happened in history, and it changes everything.
Yeah, you know, so I was actually just doing a podcast. I'm not purposely plugging the podcast, but if it works, it works. I got a podcast coming out Monday with my friend Sebastian D'Amico, and he's talking about the Shroud of Turin. And he says that based on the Shroud, Jesus is about 5'10" and 170 pounds. And so at the final judgment, there are going to be people who are just like towering above him, but still bowing down before him. But it just getting, for some reason, just hearing the height and weight, the specificity just really hammered home. Right. The fact this is a real human being. I mean, it's a divine person with a human nature. Like, this is someone who really lived, died, and rose among us.
Yeah. I have to confess to being very suspicious that the Shroud of Turin is, in fact, the cloth of Christ. It just strikes one as so authentic in so many ways. But of course, nobody has to believe that, and we're not selling you on that. But what strikes me about it is, like, if you would think to yourself, what could God do to really share with people that he had raised Christ from the dead? What if he took a photograph 1,850 years before photography was invented? That's what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. The theories about the way the light would have emanated from the body. So what I like about it, John Paul II, when he was in Turin, basically said, whether it's real or not, and it's not a matter of faith that Catholics have to believe in it or not.
No.
If it's not the actual burial of cross of Christ, it's one of the greatest icons or paintings of Christ that's ever existed. But either way, it hammers home that same point, which is that this is an event that really happened. Like, it really reminds us of the humanity of Jesus.
Yes.
And therefore the reality. So if we're trying to talk about the first century, you know, we look around us and you got a billion Catholics. And it's hard to imagine a situation in which Christianity's, most people have never even heard of it.
Yeah, that's right. Now, but what do you make of the fact that we look in the four Gospels, we read these accounts, it all seems very, it has a kind of confused, jumbled feel to it a little bit. Like, the accounts are different enough that you're like, wait, what happened? When were they in Galilee? When were they in Jerusalem? You know, that, all that kind of thing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, you know, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, I used to be an attorney, and eyewitness testimony, even when the eyewitnesses are telling the truth, often looks and sounds like that. They seem to contradict each other. People see little bits of a story.
Yeah.
Very rarely do you have someone who has the whole story kind of laid out before them, and someone with too many details and too much information, in some cases, it actually looks more suspicious. It looks like they're not telling the truth because they've kind of sorted it all out. Whereas these cases where they know a few eyewitnesses, they know part of the story, and that's what they're kind of giving us, those have a lot of the ring of authenticity.
So give us your best kind of estimation, given that the fact that it is true that eyewitness testimonies are even of the exact same event, no matter who we are, they come from two different angles. If I'm standing next to you, the angle is slightly different. But for everybody, you know, maybe some were there at some of the resurrection, some occurrences, others were not. Give me your kind of what happened on Easter Sunday.
Yeah. And so, you know, there have been attempts throughout history to try to consolidate all of this to a single gospel, to take the four gospels and replace them with just one. And the church has actually resisted that. So there is a certain amount of indeterminacy in the details that we're just going to be left with.
Okay.
Where we have the Gospels according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Right.
And we can get a general picture of it. But there's not just like Jesus gives his own perspective, his own point of view, and we don't need any of these other eyewitness accounts.
Oh, right. Like, here's what I did. Like, that would be Christ's account of the resurrection. First I did this, then I did that, and then, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, compare it to, like, Muhammad and Joseph Smith, for example. They write their own books about themselves.
Yeah.
So they're kind of their own authors. Jesus doesn't do that. He allows himself, now, certainly under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, where the information that's in there is the information that needs to be in there. But in terms of someone just hammering out saying, these events happened before these other events, that we don't get anything like that. So even getting the exact order of the events of Easter Sunday morning can be very difficult because we don't have just one person saying these events happened before. You know, the events, for example, the women coming into the tomb seems to have happened before Mary Magdalene is there by herself. But you have to kind of read between the lines even a little bit to get just that much information.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you kind of broke down in a recent podcast you did about the 15th chapter of the first letter of Paul to the Corinthians, where Paul goes into his own kind of timeline and gives us that. And again, you get a very strong sense. This is not people making a myth. This is people trying to go, okay, this happened and then this happened. And obviously, some people have more of the story than other people. But okay, so Paul has the story. And the part I think we often forget about is that he appeared to 500 people at
Yes.
the same time.
So there's a theory about this. And one of the best explanations is that this is probably the Galilee appearance. So here we're doing the very thing I just warned against doing too much, which is putting the different gospels accounts together and then comparing them with what Paul says.
Right.
So Galilee is the only appearance that is advertised ahead of time. So think about the upper room appearances. The apostles are together.
Right.
They don't know Jesus is coming. Thomas isn't even there the first time. He surprises them in the locked room. He's not saying, come back in 24 hours, I'll meet you again, or come back
right.
in 8 days. But what he does say is he tells the women at the tomb, and particularly Mary Magdalene, go and tell the others that I go before them to Galilee. And so when he appears at Galilee, it says that they believed, but some doubted. And so the question is whether this some is some of the apostles or some others. And the Greek is actually ambiguous. And so one theory, William Lane Craig is maybe the most public proponent of this, and I think it's a good theory, is that this would be the event that you'd have the appearance to the 500. That if Jesus is saying, I'm going to appear in Galilee, tell the apostles to get up there, that other people, when they catch wind of this, aren't just going to be like, oh, well, right. we weren't invited, so yeah. you go see the resurrected Christ by yourself. Of course they're going to want to come along. Of course that's going to attract a crowd. And so there are multiple promises of this apparition or this appearance of the resurrected Christ. So that's probably the appearance to the 500. Now, St. Paul does a pretty cool thing when he talks about it. He says most of them are still alive, but some have fallen asleep. So in 1 Corinthians 15, he mentions that little detail. Like, why is he telling us that? Because he's inviting people to fact check the historicity of the resurrection.
Yeah. That's also the case with the tomb of Jesus, which you emphasized in that podcast, this idea that nobody tried to hide the tomb of Jesus. No one's like, you could go and investigate yourself. I mean, you could come up with an alternate explanation if you wanted. Apparently, the authorities did, that they had stolen the body. But you couldn't, there was no one who said, oh, yeah, well, I know where Jesus is buried. That didn't happen.
Yeah, it's striking that even the theories presented by the critics of Christianity, things like, oh, the apostles stole the body, still tacitly concede that the body is not in the tomb anymore. Because if the body is in the tomb, Christianity's over by Easter Sunday afternoon. At the very least, it's over by Pentecost. You know, in Acts 2, St. Peter stands up, and in front of a crowd of thousands of Jews who are on pilgrimage for the Jewish Feast of Pentecost, he declares that Jesus is greater than King David, the most revered king in Jewish history, and says that David is still in the tomb and that Jesus isn't. That's a huge kind of bombastic sort of claim.
Right.
According to at least a Jewish tradition, the spot where King David's tomb is maybe a half a block from the upper room. I've been to the upper room, and when you come down the stairs, there's a sign for King David's tomb. So if that's the case, then Peter stood overlooking the tomb of David and declared David's still in his tomb. Jesus isn't in his.
Yeah.
And uses that to prove that David's a prophet of one greater than himself.
The resurrection of Jesus and its effect on the early church is our topic this hour. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. 888-318-7884. If you have questions about the early church, if you have questions about the resurrection of Jesus, 888-318-7884. When we come back, Joe, I want to ask you about St. Paul, because this is something, the idea of Paul's conversion being some kind of, oh, I don't know, like a self-aggrandizing thing, like he's going to make money off of this or something. When you think about what it meant for a Pharisee to start saying the things that he said and essentially condemning himself to hell if it wasn't true, is kind
exactly.
of a kind of an important detail of Paul's story. So we'll get into more about the resurrection and the early church with Joe Heschmeyer right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from Scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their Catholic values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Looking for the best in solid Catholic resources that can answer your questions on all things Catholic? Looking for books, audio, and DVDs by the top Catholic thinkers and speakers on the planet today? Stop in today and visit the shop at Catholic.com. All of our resources are time-tested, apologist-vetted, and trustworthy and faithful to the teachings of the Catholic Church. There's truly no better source for solid Catholic resources anywhere on the internet. And now, we've made your online shopping even more affordable with $5 flat rate shipping within the continental U.S. When you're shopping for great Catholic books, CDs, DVDs, and more, turn to someone you can trust. Visit the shop at Catholic.com today. That's shop.catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. We're talking about the resurrection of Jesus. Maybe you have a doubt about the resurrection of Jesus. Your call is welcome. Maybe you'd like to know more about what actually did the early church experience, and what did that experience mean in their lives? Joe's happy to talk with you about those things. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, 888-318-7884. Paul says to the Corinthians, I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, and then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me, for I am the least of the apostles, unfit to be called an apostle. Very humble there of Paul at the end, but a shattering experience for a Pharisee who was very zealous and took personal offense at the Christian church, because clearly other Pharisees were not persecuting the early church. I mean, we get his own teacher, apparently, Gamaliel, was not persecuting the church. So this is a personal thing for Paul. He hates Christians. And so it's devastating to him. But I mean, devastating of his former self.
Yeah, I think it's a striking conversion. I mean, obviously, it's kind of the classic conversion people point to, of doing sort of a 180. Because, yeah, he studies under Gamaliel. He's one of the rising stars in Judaism and Pharisaism particularly. And then he more than throws it all away. Like, these are people he's actively hunting down to kill. And then he sides with them. It's sort of unheard of. It's one of those things where it cries out for an explanation just from a historical perspective. Like, if you want to say Paul is lying or that he's deluded or whatever, like, you have to give some sort of account for why he would have this kind of turnaround, burning every bridge he has.
Right. And his understanding of his Jewish faith, what he was engaged in once he did go through this conversion, earlier Paul would have said he's a blasphemer. He's now engaged in blaspheming the Lord.
So this is something that I think gets too often left out of the story. Because people will say, oh, well, you know, people will lie for money or for fame or for glory. Well, leave aside that the apostles don't really get any of that stuff.
Right.
And they wouldn't have realistically expected to get any of that stuff. You also have just the reality that these are, by all accounts, people who, prior to converting to Christianity, were pious Jews. Some of them were simple fishermen. Some of them maybe weren't well respected, like a tax collector like Matthew. But then St. Paul, he's a golden boy.
Yeah.
And so to embrace Christianity, it's not just a torture and death sentence. It's not just that you're going to be ostracized from your entire community. It's not just that the Romans are going to hate you and persecute you now. It's also that after all that, after you get ostracized, after you get tortured, after you get killed, then you go to hell for all eternity, because Judaism is fiercely monotheistic.
Right. Especially the Pharisaic Judaism. It's not like he was one of the
Sadducees. Or the Essenes or something. He's really a by the books Pharisaic Jew. But the whole message of the Old Testament is there is no God but God. Like, this is a constant message that's being reiterated in the Old Testament. Every time they start to fall into idolatry, he brings them back again. And the message is there's no God but God. And this is something that you pray every day. The Shema Israel.
Yeah.
It's like literally every Jew who is practicing prays this prayer every morning from Deuteronomy, acknowledging that there is no God other than the one God, that God is one. And so when Christianity comes along and says, Jesus is God.
Right.
To their ears, they're not hearing Trinitarian theology.
No, right.
Not at first. They're hearing polytheism. They're hearing a rejection of the Old Testament,
right?
Or kind of paying it lip service while introducing some idolatrous paganist element.
Yeah.
And so especially at a time when there's a really strong anti-Roman, anti-Greek kind of influence in Judaism, because like the Romans were the occupying, oppressing power. This sounds like both blasphemy and incorporating the worst elements of the oppressor culture.
Yeah. 888-318-7884 is the number. We're talking about the resurrection of Jesus and the early church. Let's go to, if you're ready to go to calls, shall we go to calls?
Joe? Yeah, let's go to calls.
Let's go to Joe in Denver, Colorado, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. Joel, your question for Joe. Joel? I know.
Not sure Joel was ready.
No, they're used to blaming me around here for whenever, but I don't know what happened to Joel. Let's go to an anonymous caller. Anonymous, your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Is that me?
That's you, Anonymous.
Okay. I've seen several YouTube debates with Dr. Richard Carrier. He's a mythicist. And I've heard some other mythicist cases presented that were not very good at all. But his particular brand of mythicism seems actually fairly convincing. In several of his debates, he is, I thought successfully defended the claim that there are no authentic extra-biblical references to a real physical flesh and blood Jesus. He makes a comparison between Christianity and the cargo cults of like John.
Oh yeah, yeah, right. Okay,
and
so.
Last thing, he seems to make a pretty convincing case that Christianity and all of the most reliable texts we have, he says that regarding Jesus and, you know, whether he was some celestial being or a physical being or whatever, he says that those are just like a bunch of other mystery religions in the ancient pagan world.
Yeah, except that they're not. But yeah, Anonymous, thanks very, very much for that. You did a very nice job outlining Richard Carrier's beliefs. They are astonishingly ill-informed, I think. But I'll let you, Joe, explain why that is the case.
Yeah, so I'd say a few things. First, the idea that we don't have any extra biblical references to Christ is untrue. So the Annals of Tacitus are one of the places we hear about Christ. Now, a few things out the gate. Most people aren't writing biographies of Jesus. If you're like a pious Jew or a pagan Roman, and you're not converting to Christianity, why would you be writing any sort of like in-depth just examination of Jesus as a person? There are some early arguments against Christianity. Octavius Felix is, if memory serves, is one of them. But we get these occasional references just from a historical or sociological perspective. So occasionally get these Romans or Jews who just mention the existence of Christianity almost as an aside. So a little bit of history. In 64, there's the Great Fire of Rome, and this is a terrible fire. And there is a theory, quite possibly true, that the Emperor Nero had purposely caused this fire in Rome to build a larger palace for himself. He burns down an area and then builds a palace on that spot with new and improved streets, everything else. Well, obviously, the people of Rome aren't thrilled with the emperor burning down their city or a chunk of it. And so he needs a scapegoat, and he blames the Christians. And we know that he blames the Christian because a Roman senator named Tacitus records all of this in a history that he wrote of Rome 50 years later. Well, no, not even, yeah, 40 years later. So he's about as close to the events as we are to, say, Watergate today. And it was just as controversial. So he's writing as someone who lived in Rome from his 20s, someone who was a senator who had access to the Senate records, and someone who's remarking on one of the biggest events in the city of Rome shortly after it, like a few decades after it. And he includes this bit about how, I'll quote it. He says, "Therefore, to scotch the rumor, namely the rumor that he'd started the fire, Nero substituted as culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Christus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by a sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate, and the pernicious superstition was checked for a moment only to break out once more, not merely in Judea, the home of the disease, but in the capital itself. Now, he goes on from there, but notice what he's done there. He said there was a Jesus, a Christus, who suffered under Pontius Pilate, and this was in Judea, and it briefly looked like they'd beaten the religion, but then it just kind of caught fire to the point that by 64, the Christians are a big enough minority in Rome that they're someone that Nero can pick on. They're hated enough and they're well known enough that the people persecuting them know who the Christians are. So that's a passing reference to Christ. I mean, if you consider who Jesus is, you know, of course, they're not writing biographies in the year 30.
Joe, I know you want to address more of that, and where the music explains why to take a break. Anonymous, hang on a second, because the mythicist arguments are worth taking some time to refute, but they are not difficult to refute. So we'll let Joe Heschmeyer do that when we come back. Thanks for reading Tacitus to us. That was kind of fun. We'll be right back with more with Joe Heschmeyer after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As the legend goes, the Protestant Reformation began when Martin Luther nailed the list of his grievances with the Catholic Church to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany. But do you know the whole story? In Catholic Answers' brand new documentary, The Protestant Revolution, you will hear from top apologists Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Carla Broussard, Trent Horn, and Steve Weidenkopf as they expose the errors of Martin Luther and of the other so-called reformers. This DVD will give you a clearer understanding of our Protestant brothers and sisters, and you will be better equipped to engage them about what separates us and about what unites us. Order your copy of The Protestant Revolution today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting shop.catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. You can find out all about Joe at shamelesspopery.com. That's his blog, Shameless Popery. It's just great, too. I think I'm always seeing people connecting to articles and things that you do there, Joe, and it's very much appreciated. Shamelesspopery.com. But we're talking about the resurrection today from the perspective of what actually happened in the early church. It can be confusing, and there's all these kinds of theories that people will throw out about it. But it's pretty hard to deny that that nothing happened, or that, you know, that something major happened. And so our anonymous caller, who I hope is here still with us, mentions Richard Carrier and his mythicist arguments, that that's all just a big myth. There's no real reliable historical records about it. You read Tacitus to us. Continue from there, Joe Heschmeyer.
Yeah. So there we also have Josephus records some reference to Christ. The reference itself may have been tampered with, but no one seriously disputes that he at least mentions a Jesus existed.
Right.
Even if we don't know his exact words, all parties scholarly agree on this much. So we have Jewish and
if
Roman
I may,
sources.
Joe, that's an important point. I just wanted that scholars, there's virtually no disagreement among scholars of the ancient world that Jesus certainly existed and he certainly was a person of some significance, at least locally. I mean, so this is we're not just appealing to our own lights here. Richard Carrier is not a serious scholar, and serious scholars are in general agreement about the existence of Jesus of Nazareth.
Right. There's sometimes a skeptical bias that says we'll only accept extra biblical evidence, and not just extra biblical, but extra biblical and non-Christian, because there are a lot of first century documents by Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, and so on within what is now the New Testament that speak about eyewitness accounts. You also have early Christian sources like the Didache. You've got the first letter of Clement in about 96 AD. You've got the Epistle of Barnabas. You've got these other Christian sources that aren't part of Scripture, but speak to the belief of the early Christian community, much of it centered on their own eyewitness testimony. So in light of all of that, to just say we're going to ignore everyone who saw Jesus, who believed him, because we don't consider them historical. We're only going to take those people who don't believe in Jesus, and then we want to build the story of Jesus around them. That's bizarre, just historically speaking. That'd be a very strange way to approach any other historical figure, to take only non-Roman sources to describe Julius Caesar, for example, would end up with a skewed vision of Caesar.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I was going to say, in addition to that, so you got the Old Testament, New Testament stuff. So there's also this claim that maybe just Jesus didn't exist at all. And okay, so take just the historical reality that in the first century, there are these Christian texts describing the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And then in the first century, by 60, there's a big enough movement into Rome of people following Jesus. And you're going to tell me that all of those people are following a non-existent person? Not just that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, but that Jesus never existed? Why would they follow? I mean, this is not like the John Frum cults. The John Frum cults, people really got goods that came from cargo planes. They'd never seen planes before, and they sought to understand the evidence. But there was real data there that they were trying and failing to interpret. So this is just so different than that. These are people claiming they saw the risen Christ.
And it's at a time as well, you can go back there and ask people. You can go to Nazareth. Just walk to Nazareth and Does anybody remember this guy Jesus? If he didn't exist, I mean, you know, Paul's writing his letters. I don't know what would we say? Maybe 25 years after.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good estimate.
Yeah, Anonymous, if you're still with us, any follow up?
I'm sorry. What was that?
Any follow up?
Let's see here. I guess I don't know. It seems like he seems so confident, cool, calm, and collected when he debates people like when he debated Trent Horn or when he debated Craig Evans. I guess why does he seem so confident and convincing if there's really nothing to it?
I think politeness prohibits me from giving a full answer to that question.
I don't know that the confidence of the speaker is a basis on which to accept what people are saying. I mean, just look at our politicians. Let us go now to Joel in Denver, Colorado, listening on Sirius. I think you hung up on me or I hung up on you, Joel. I don't know which it was, so let's not blame each other. What's your question?
There's grace to go around.
Though. Amen, brother.
I like your attitude, Joel.
Absolutely. So in discussions with unbelievers, or better yet, potential objects of God's mercy, there's one part of the apologetic task I've not been quite convinced with, and I was hoping you could help, and that is what I've read before in some of the apologetics literature about the testimony of women in the first century and the credibility of it. And the idea that the gospel writers would not have made up women as reliable people to attest to the resurrection if that indeed had not been the case. And I was looking for some maybe contemporary sources and your own thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I think it is true. So women's testimony wasn't even accepted in court if it was uncorroborated, rather. That they just weren't viewed as being logical or reliable in the way men were in that culture. And so to take people who are already going to be subject to that kind of aspersion and build testimony around them, it doesn't seem like what you would do if you were making up the story from scratch. I mean, you can add to that the fact that they use like fishermen and a tax collector as some of the early witnesses as well. These are just not the people you would choose. So I would look at that. I would add another maybe side point too, which is if you look at the names, an inordinate number of them are named Mary. So you've got like the mother of God. You've got Mary of Bethany. You've got Mary Magdalene, who may or may not be the same person. You've got Mary, the wife of Clopas, on and on down the list. This is a small detail, but like any halfway decent author isn't going to name 12 of his characters Mary, unless he's just reporting that this was in fact a very common name and is just reporting the facts. So, I mean, compare it to any work of literature and find me the same thing where you have 12 characters with the same name or what have you. So it's these small details that point to the authenticity and the accuracy. I don't think the fact that it was women who went to the tomb is alone enough to show that the Gospels are credible. But I think that all of these are little bits of evidence that point to the fact that it doesn't appear to be made up.
Joel?
Very good. Thank you very much. Very helpful.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I also think it's one of the delightful things about Christianity, if I may say Joe, that the status of women was raised so much by the advent of Christian culture that out of being essentially property, I mean, a woman is not even a civil subject in the Roman Empire. She doesn't own things. She can't bring a court case. She can't have any civil office at all. And that changes entirely. The status of women changes entirely with the advent of Christian culture.
There's a very simple litmus test you can do for this. Go back 100 years and see what things were named after women. You've got a few things named after queens, but overwhelmingly what's named after women are churches and, you know, devotional things connected to female saints.
I see what you're saying, is that it's within the church that women are honored in that way.
Yeah, this kind of veneration of women that you get within the Catholic Church throughout history.
Yeah.
That's not to say there aren't male sexists. I mean, obviously there are.
No, and there's a whole history
being
of sexism.
Catholic doesn't. Right. But not just a Catholic history, just a history of it.
But the gospel is a counterweight to that. As the gospel permeates a culture, then that becomes diminished, because it's hard to have someone like St. Paul say that in Christ there's neither man nor woman, slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile, and think that those distinctions are. It's also true. It's also the case that following the resurrection of Jesus and the spreading of the gospel, the status of children is, as a matter of fact, the very idea that a child is a fully human creature does not exist in the Roman Empire.
One of the early things that set the Christians apart from the Romans is that they wouldn't leave their children out to die if they didn't like them. Because the Romans would practice afterbirth eugenics, where if you had a baby who was deformed or who seemed like they might have like developmental difficulties or was a girl when you were wanting a boy, you'd leave them on the hills and they would die. And the Christians wouldn't do it.
888-318-7884 is our number. We're talking about the resurrection and its effect on the early church. What happened and how did that – what happened affect those to whom it happened in the ancient world? Let's go now to Genevieve in Loveland, Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. Genevieve, your question for Joe Heschmeyer.
Yes. Oh, I thought I just told you the – okay, I need to repeat it.
Oh, yeah, you're on the air now.
Okay,
yeah, you were just talking to Nathan before. He's much more charming.
Okay. I know that on the third day Jesus rose, but he had been down into the dead or to hell, and then he went up to heaven and sits at the right hand of the Father, like the creed says. But where is – I've never heard what happened, what he saw, who he saw, who – what did he feel down in hell, and what did he feel up in heaven, or who did he see? Did he talk to the Father? I mean, is there anything such as that?
Yes, there's a great – there's little references to this in the New Testament, And then some of the early Christian sources describe it or imagine it a little more. So you have St. Peter in his epistle talks about Christ rose again. And what does it mean? And then St. Paul does as well and says, what does it mean to rise again except to have descended? So there is this notion that there is a descent into hell. Now, what we need to do here is clarify what the early Christians meant by hell compared to what we mean by hell today. So in Judaism, this notion of Hades or Sheol is often used as a catch-all term to describe the place where the dead go after they die and are awaiting judgment. Within that, there was a sense that there was both an abode of the righteous and an abode of the damned. And so we get a pretty clear reference to this in Luke 16, when Jesus tells the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. Both of them die, and they go into what can broadly be called hell. But the rich man goes into the hell of damnation, what we normally think of as hell. Lazarus goes into what's called the bosom of Abraham. And so this is also sometimes called the limbo of the fathers. And so it's not a place of torment. It's a place of waiting, because even those who die in a state of grace haven't been redeemed by Christ's blood on the cross yet. And so after Good Friday, Christ redeems them, and then he visits them announcing his triumph. There's a beautiful first or second century homily about this, if memory serves. It's the Office of Readings for Holy Saturday, and it describes Christ going and visiting Adam. But we don't know all of the details of what that would have looked like. 1 Peter 3, he describes him as going to those from Noah's day, but we get just little bits of fragmentary information.
Genevieve, we'll have to leave it there because I'm a little late for a break, but thank you so much for that call. I hope that was helpful. We're talking about the resurrection with Joe Heschmeyer this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Our number, 888-318-7884. If you have questions about the resurrection or about its effect on the earliest members of the church, 888-318-7884. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers. Our success depends on you. Can you trust the basis of the Christian faith? The Christian faith is under constant attack today in numerous ways, but the attack that does the most damage is the one that asks a deceptively simple question. What if your faith is based on a myth? The skeptics come with arguments to cast doubt in numerous ways, often attacking the reliability of the New Testament and the Gospels. And the sad news is that most people don't know how to answer these charges. The good news is that there are answers to each and every one of them. Good, solid answers. That's why Catholic Answers Studios has just released Jimmy Akin's new DVD, The Dawn of Christian History. With his characteristic wit and passion as a master storyteller, Jimmy takes you through an exciting detective story that reveals how history supports the Christian faith. Order your copy of The Dawn of Christian History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Did you know that Catholic Answers Live is on TV? What began as a monthly series on EWTN in April of 2017 is now going to be coming to you on a weekly basis. You can catch Catholic Answers Live TV Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN, with an encore at 2:30 a.m. on Sundays. We'll also be available soon on Apple TV, Roku, and the Augustine Institute's multimedia platform, Form. Make a point of making Catholic Answers Live TV part of your weekly viewing, and we'll see you on the airwaves.
Call now with your question. 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Oh, gotta go. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. We're having a lot of fun at the breaks and with the calls, talking about the resurrection of Jesus. It is the Easter season, and these are good things to meditate on. The saints, you know, they always tell us, don't spend so much time meditating on the negative things. Remember heaven. Think about heaven. Remember the resurrection of Jesus. Think about the resurrection of Jesus. These things are the things that give you real Christian hope.
Absolutely. I was talking with Troy Hinkle, my boss, or one of my bosses, about just like we need to imagine heaven more. I mean, there's this notion which heaven is unimaginable, but fear of hell only gets you so far. And so the desire for union with God is something that we need to take very seriously. And the reality of the resurrection, because if that's true, then our faith is sure, and we've got so much reason to hope, and we should be overflowing with love in response.
Yeah, amen to that, brother. That's exactly right. How do you think, and I'm going to go right back to callers, and if you have a call for Joe, 888-318-7884 is the number. But I think I grew up with a skewed view of how Christianity spread at the beginning, that it was just this slow, arduous plod, and the apostles were getting slapped in the face everywhere they went, or had to climb out a window and go down in a basket, or, you know, that it was always that way. But that's not really the real story of how Christianity spread after the resurrection.
Yeah, it's a much more dynamic story than that. You know, go back to Acts 2 and look at all of the different languages and peoples and areas that are described as being there, and realize that they saw something miraculous, and 3,000 of them converted on Pentecost. Well, they were just pilgrims. They were there just for, you know, a few days. They were going to go home, and they were going to talk about what they saw. And they would have seen people who'd been there at Calvary. But then they experience something just incredible, and then they go home. And so when you see like St. Paul going to Rome, he's not saying, I've got to plant the Christian community here because they've never heard of the gospel. So even though Peter and Paul founded the church institutionally, there are already people there who've heard the gospel message, and they probably came originally from this Pentecost crowd.
So Peter's the founder of the church in Rome in two ways, from the time of Pentecost and people go back to Rome, and then from his coming there as Peter.
that's a great point.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty incredible story.
So this idea that Christianity stayed very small for a long time is kind of belied by that story you told too about Nero in the year. Was it 64 that the 64, fire of Rome was? So that's 34 years, if we use the usual dating, after the death and resurrection of Christ. You've already got this sizable minority right there in the heart of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, like that really speaks to this explosion of Christianity. And like, so there's a lot of this stuff where it is a little more speculative, and you have to kind of wonder what happens.
Yeah.
So if memory serves, I'm going off of stuff I read like a year ago. If memory serves, there were about 5 million Jews living in the Roman Empire in the first century.
Right.
And like three centuries later, there's only like a million. And so there's this question of like 80% decline is pretty shocking.
Yeah.
And part of that was almost certainly Roman persecution. You know, they had a horrible crackdown in 70. There's a destruction of the Sadducees after that and all of that. But that doesn't account for this whole decline. It doesn't appear to. So there seems to have been a mass conversion of Jewish believers into Christians as well that partly fuels this huge rise. Because at first the Romans are just seeing this as a Jewish thing, which tells us that a lot of the early converts are Jewish. But clearly, as Acts tells us, like there's a quick influx of Gentiles as well, and quite a few.
Well, I mean, this is another thing that I think we're not taught when we first learn the history of it, is how popular Judaism was because of this one God who was a God of justice, who cared for. I mean, Judaism is the most wonderful religion of the ancient world, There were many people around Judaism who were around the synagogue who were not themselves Jews as well, who may have been among the first converts.
Yeah, you know, the great Greek philosophers kind of end up on this idea of monotheism just reasonably, that the kind of Roman idea of like a pantheon of gods and gods who behave in this kind of ludicrous way doesn't hold up to rational scrutiny. That doesn't account for the unified structure of reality or the fact that we don't seem to be living in the kind of world Zeus would have made.
Right. Thank the Lord for that.
Yes.
We got another anonymous caller. I don't know why everybody's anonymous talking about the resurrection. The government does allow us to talk about the resurrection. It's still legal. Anonymous, your question for Joe.
Hello?
Hi. Your question for Joe?
Oh, hey, good day. Mary Magdalene, I mean, she was there. She was part of the whole scene then. With the resurrection afterwards, she's a believer, what others weren't. I don't understand why she doesn't have more prominent position with the church in terms of how apostolic succession developed.
Oh, that's a great question.
Coming from the disciples.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so Jesus has some amazing female followers, Mary Magdalene being, amongst them. Obviously, his own mother is the first Christian. And yet, when he chooses his disciples, he chooses 12 men and invests them with authority and gives them the authority to celebrate the Mass at the Last Supper. He institutes the Eucharist and then tells them, do this in remembrance of me. That's a commission to go out and do the same. And so if you read Acts, you see that group of men going and doing things like ordaining successors by laying on of hands. And that's where you get apostolic succession from. So the short answer is that even though she's sometimes called the apostle to the apostles, Mary Magdalene isn't one of the 12 disciples who are sent out by Christ. This is a choice that he makes. So very briefly, I'd say the reason women's ordination doesn't happen in the church is because it can't happen. The reason it can't happen is because Jesus didn't choose any women as the first priests and didn't give instructions for us to do the same, for us to do otherwise, rather. And then ultimately, that it seems to be because the priest is in a fatherly role. You know, a woman can be a doctor or a lawyer or a president or whatever, but she can't be a father. And so all of this points to the paternal role that a priest has. It's why we call priests father, because we think of it more as a relationship than as a job. And so this is expressed. And parent is a neutral term. There's something about the fatherhood of God being shown in the priest, and something of this paternal relationship to the flock being shown in the priest. And then finally, the priest stands in relationship to the church like Christ does as bridegroom to the bride. So the church is the bride, and the priest represents Christ, the bridegroom.
Anonymous, how does that strike you?
Okay. Hey, thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you very much. And it's such an important question because obviously it is true that Mary Magdalene plays this enormously prominent role in the early church, and yet is not among the 12 apostles. That's not an accident. There's not a mistake
right.
on Jesus' part.
Right, and you can't just say, oh, it's the culture at the time. Sometimes people will say, well, of course he didn't choose any women. People were sexist back then. But
there were women priests all over the Roman Empire.
Yeah, there are
thing.
Roman priestesses. There are female Jewish prophetesses like Anna in Luke 2.
Right.
And so clearly the idea of a woman having religious authority wasn't that radical. What was radical, by the way, incorporating Jews and Gentiles, and he had no problem doing that, nor did he have a problem having women be the first witnesses of the resurrection. So this clearly isn't because of sexism.
It's striking, too, that the resurrection of Christ is kind of received into an institution he's already created, that there's 12 apostles, there's 70 disciples, there's a wider group of maybe 500 or 600 faithful. He already had built these things, which makes it – it's not it kind of argues against a mythic character for the thing too, because you never have myths where there's – he was here. He developed an entire system for how his people are to do business, and then he came back and then sent them out having been established.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just an incredible thing. This is, getting back to, like you said, the mythic thing. He's so different than that. To have recent history being told in this place at this time, this happened.
Yeah.
By sources just writing a couple decades later. They're very clear. Like these, you know, St. Paul says when he's on trial, these things did not happen in the corner.
Oh,
like this was not some secret thing.
Yeah.
This is very public. And so they point to the publicity as a proof of Catholicism or of Christianity originally.
Right, right. It's always so wonderful to keep digging into it. Joe Heschmeyer, I love spending time with you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
If you want to know more about Joe, if you want to be in contact with him, go to shamelesspopery.com. He writes very well there. You also do this podcast. What's the podcast called?
Yeah, the podcast is called The Catholic Podcast, and you can go to cathpod.com.
Yeah, that's very humble. The Catholic Podcast, Joe. I'm really impressed with your humility.
The creativity. Brandon Boatman.
Brandon, all right. Yeah. Thanks again, Joe Heschmeyer. Tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live, 2 hours of open forum. Jimmy Akin will be here. Father John Trujillo will be here. We're going to have more fun than you're supposed to be allowed to have on a Thursday. We'll play some groovy music, and we'll answer any question from anyone of any background about the Catholic Church. We'll just take them one at a time and do the best we can. See you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.